While the nation's economy sputters, Massachusetts can consider itself relatively fortunate with an unemployment rate well below the national average. Around Boston, the local job market gets a big boost from a concentration of universities, a steady stream of research grants, and spin-off corporations in fields such as biotech, robotics, and computer software.
Just take a walk around Kendall Square in Cambridge, and you can't avoid concluding that investment in science is paying off in a big way in the form of new companies and jobs. A lot of that is due to tight partnerships between university labs, the high-tech sector, and venture capitalists. The state's biotech companies alone employed 48,000 people last year, paying out $4.6 billion in payroll. So everybody wins, right?
Well, maybe not. Philip Morawski says American science is actually declining, largely because of the way scientific research is being funded these days. The system may be producing jobs now, but is it developing great science for tomorrow? Morawski is a professor of economics and the history and philosophy of science at the University of Notre Dame. His new book is called Science Mart: Privatizing American Science. In it, he argues the quest for profits is leading the country away from important scientific discoveries, pushing scientific research overseas, and threatening the country's technological and industrial edge. And Philip Morawski joins us now from the University of Notre Dame in South Bend. And welcome to Radio Boston, Professor Morawski. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Now, one of the central arguments you make in this book is that since the Cold War, there's been a big shift in the way science research is financed in America. How has that changed since the Cold War?
It's changed in a number of ways. I mean, the most obvious way is that increasingly the military is not willing to be able to act as the science manager anymore. And so what's happened is that we've, as in so many other sectors of society, we've come to privatize many of the functions of scientific research that previously might be carried on and funded in other ways. And this happens through issues like the increased power of intellectual property. This happens by encouraging faculty members to form their own startups and look for venture capital in order to fund their science. And it also happens in a grand change in the way in which science is conducted, even in corporations. Earlier, during the Cold War, most corporations would have in-house science capacity, which would work on issues having to do with, you know, their products. And what we've seen since 1980 is a grand outsourcing of research itself to other units. Sometimes the units are universities, sometimes they're contract research organizations, and sometimes they're even organizations in other countries like China.
But basically what we're talking about is a sort of privatizing of American science. And there's a lot in what you just told me, and I want to sort of go through a couple of those points at least that you raised. But let me ask you about the Cold War and the way science was funded in that period. And let me ask you this question. Was it really better for science when so much of the effort and research was being focused around building weapons? I mean, I would think that you could make a pretty strong case that we're better off letting the market guide research rather than the Pentagon, or not so.
Look, I don't want to idealize the Cold War,
yeah,
because one of the points that I make in the book is that science is always organized by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It's always organized by a particular sector. When it was organized by the military, of course, it would be bent more towards some of their interests. But there was also, I think, a deep appreciation of the way in which science had to be organized for the long term to develop the science base. And another way to do that was to essentially recruit scientists by telling them that they were working for the public good, that they were working for humanity in general, or and possibly for the country. Okay. The difference is when you shift away from that model to the current model, what you have instead is that people are very much attuned to wanting to make money off knowledge in a reasonably short period of time.
Mm.
So, for example, during the Cold War, there would be willingness to fund research projects and research groups over 10 years, 15 years. Now, with a venture capitalist, I mean, you're lucky if you can get 5 years of you know, burning up your money before either you have to have an IPO, get bought up by some firm like Big Pharma, or else you go bust. And this has been commented upon by much of the business press. For example, Price Waterhouse released a study last year that said that the biotech sector model has failed. That is, that it is not churning out new drugs. And as a whole, the sector is not profitable. Some individual firms are profitable for a short time, but that's partly because of the model. The model says that they have to be bought up almost immediately in order to succeed. So what you get is you get a thin veneer of something like 5% of all these startups actually getting bought up or having an IPO, and the rest of them failing. Well, so this is not the kind of model that you could have a whole science base built upon.
Interesting. Well, you heard the introduction that Megan and I read, and we made reference to a part of this city, Kendall Square, for example, sure. In Cambridge. It looks like private investment in science is paying off pretty well there. But you're suggesting that it's not doing it in a deep and sustainable way.
That's correct. And moreover, there are measures of harm of science that I think people have not been willing to look at. In other words, it's quite easy to point to Kendall Square. It's not so easy to look at the aggregate of the science base in the United States and try to decide what's happening. And in the book, I document a number of possible warning signs of what's happening to science. So, for example, most people don't know that the number of papers, adequately adjusted for certain considerations by Americans in most science have been falling. And it's been falling over the last 15 years or so. So there's the possibility, I'm not saying it's proof, but there's a possibility that the quantity of science being done is actually falling in the aggregate. Moreover, the quality of science might be falling too. And of course, this is an even touchier issue. Hmm. But it's admitted by both the OECD and by the U.S. Patent Office that there's been severe patent degradation over the last two decades.
And what does that mean, patent degradation? Do you mean fewer
patents? The quality of an individual patent has fallen. Hmm. That is, more and more things are being patented that actually wouldn't have been patented more than 20 years ago. And so what happens is you get really silly patents or really sort of niggling patents on all sorts of things that don't really represent substantial scientific change. So when universities trot, especially technology transfer offices, trot out the number of patents that their university has produced in the last year, that's actually a pretty meaningless statement because it doesn't control for the fact that patents have become less scientifically advanced, and at the same time that they have become more valuable because they're more useful for blocking other business models. So it's more a business phenomenon than it is a scientific phenomenon.
Well, Philip Murawski, it's a fascinating argument. Listeners, what do you make of Philip Murawski's argument? His book is called Science Mart, Privatizing American Science. The title sort of speaks for itself, and you've been listening to the argument. What do you make of it? Is privatization of American science bad for science? What about the magic of the marketplace? You can join this conversation, or if you have questions for Philip Murawski, give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Philip Murawski, I want to ask you about this. You trace a big part of what you call the privatizing of American science to the long, slow trend of defunding public higher education in this country. How has that contributed to this problem?
A lot of what happens in science doesn't happen, of course, in a vacuum. It happens with response to other societal and economic trends. And some of the most important trends that affect the American science base now are, first, the deindustrialization of America. You never get a vibrant, active science base without a vibrant manufacturing sector. So as the manufacturing sector wanes, there's actually less support to have a scientific research base within the country, both politically and from a monetary view. And then, of course, the thing that you point out is pretty obvious, that the monetary contraction of universities is also influencing the science base. Most people don't know this, that the share of actual faculty who do research as a total, as a percentage of the total number of employees of universities has been falling. and it's been falling for more than a decade now. So if you have fewer researchers per university, it doesn't matter how brilliant they are. You know, you can't be generating the same kind of science base that you had 20 years ago. So and the contraction goes further than that. I just read in Nature the other day that, did you know that the University of Texas is threatening to close half of its physics programs and its 24 campuses? And the reason is as a cost-saving measure, first, but second, because they can't attract adequate numbers of students in who then graduate in the field.
So this is a real effect we're seeing? People are choosing not to go into science because of this decline?
Sure. I mean, look, here's your choice. Back in the Cold War, you could go into science because you wanted to, you know, find the truth of the universe or help mankind. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go into science, you learn that the major objective that you always have to keep your eye on is whether you're doing something that's going to be commercialized or not. And if that is the reason that you're supposed to go into science, because you wanted to commercialize something and make money, there are a lot better ways to go make money fast than to go into science. And so, of course, most American students actually are more and more put off by scientific careers.
Well, let me bring another voice into this conversation. Vineet Nijhawan is the managing director of the Office of Technology Development at Boston University, where he works to license intellectual property developed at the university. He's also worked as a venture capitalist and built several startup technology companies of his own. And Professor Nijhawan, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Anthony.
So you've been listening to Philip Murawski. I'd love just your response. Do you think that what he calls the privatizing of American science is bad for science, particularly given your position here at BU?
Well, I would definitely agree with him about the organization of science. Undoubtedly, coming out of the Second World War, U.S. science public policy was established by Vannevar Bush and others, and created NSF, which then created NIH, and what we think of basic research that we're conducting today basically started, 60 years ago. Over that period of time, the private sector's share of basic research has gone up dramatically. In other words, the federal government's share of basic research, grew to somewhere about, $100 billion in 2007 dollars. With half of that going to universities, half going to government labs. But the private sector side of it went from being very little to almost 200 plus billion.
Right. So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a great thing. Mm-hmm. So, if the professor's argument is that, curiosity-driven research is not being done anymore because it's being crowded out by commercially driven research, I disagree with that. I don't see any numbers that support that.
Philip Murawski, do you want to respond to that?
It isn't about whether you can talk about an obvious distinction between basic science and applied science. I mean, that's an old argument in the science policy community. What I'm talking about instead is what kind of science base do you build and maintain to develop research over a long period of time and follow it up in ways that might not be anticipated, when you write that original grant or something like that. And so the real issue here is, what are the obstacles in the way of the conduct of science that are thrown up by issues like all kinds of new intellectual property restrictions being placed on research, on issues like the close occupation of lawyers in all kinds of decisions about research that never happened before, even about the privatization of the reporting of research. You know that most journals are becoming privatized now too in many ways. And so so that you have to have pay-per-view now. It's not open to your average person who might want to follow up a certain set of issues. I mean, you run into that in the web all the time.
Yeah, Phil Murawski, let me just interrupt, because I want to actually get Vineet Nijhawan to respond to this concern about the quality of long-term scientific research that Philip Murawski seems to be raising an issue about. Your response to that?
Yeah, so I would say that the U.S. in a way has been you know, helping the rest of the planet by doing the majority of that kind of research, you know, over the past 60 years. And I think it's not a bad thing that, other countries who are now economically rising are starting to, you know, conduct their own fair share of basic research. And I think the model that, you know, has worked in the U.S., and yes, there are probably, you know, people are always trying to put walls up or, you know, walled gardens around them, but the idea that university research particularly is available for the benefit of mankind, the university research publish all the time. In fact, to tell you the truth, for me in my office, I see so little of the research that's being done at BU that's actually patented, because most researchers here aren't interested in commercializing. I would like more of them to be interested, and I suspect most commercialization offices around universities around the country face the same thing as me. But sort of coming back to the big point, I don't think it's such a bad thing that basic research is going to be done in other countries, because it'll benefit everybody. You know, as Amar Bhire, who's also an economist at Columbia University, you know, wrote in his book, The Venturesome Economy, that most economic gains actually go to those societies that adopt new ideas and technologies faster than others.
Philip Murawski, I'd love you to respond to that. I also want to let you know that we've got a bunch of listeners on the line who want to join this conversation. But if you want to quickly respond to what Mr. Najawan said.
Sure. Yeah. A common story about what's happening to science in the last 20 or 30 years is that what we're seeing is development in other countries like China. And so, of course, the United States can't be as dominant as it used to be in science. I mean, that's a very common story. I talk about that quite a lot in the book, and I argue that while that's true, that doesn't explain some of the measures of the degradation of science that I identify in the book. So, for example, it's not surprising that United States authors would be a smaller proportion of published science over time. But that does not explain the absolute fall in the number of scientific papers being published in the United States over time. So we mustn't confuse those two things. Hmm. That there, of course, there's a proportional issue here that science is growing in other countries. And there's a second response, and that is the science that's growing in other countries is not the Cold War science. It also is privatized science. So many of the issues that I'm raising are issues in China as well as issues in the United States. Hmm. It's not simply a matter of they're developing, so that's why they're having the rise in their science base. It's not that simple.
Let's get some callers in. This is a fascinating conversation about the future of American science and the privatizing of American science. Let's go to Philip, who's calling from Billerica. Hi, Philip. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say at the outset that I am a scientist myself. I work for a federal science-based regulatory agency. I have a daughter and a son-in-law who are both PhDs. So this is a subject that I'm fairly familiar with, and I want to make a comment slash ask a question. I just feel like my perception in my work and speaking to my children is that science is changing, but it's not necessarily getting worse. And the perception I get from the author is that things are worse because they're different. And I just wonder if he would maybe speak to that aspect of the points that he makes in his book, because from what I see in my daily work, working with IRBs, working with scientists, and also speaking with my children, both of whom are actively engaged in university research, I think that the research community in America, although it may be smaller and it may be privatized, is very robust, and I think we still lead the world, despite what doomsayers might point out. I just wonder if he could speak to that.
Sure, Philip. Thanks for the comment and question. Professor Murawski.
Yeah, I do want to point out how science is different now, because I think that's one of the first things that we need to understand, that it isn't just a matter that the same kind of science is being done that used to be done, only now it's just being privatized. What my book is about is how the privatization movement alters the kind of science that's being done. And that's why I talk about many of these issues of both input and output, like falling papers, patent degradation, falling shares of researchers in the United States. I mean, these are all absolute problems relative to what existed before. So what I'm interested in is, what is this doing to the scientific research base in the United States?
And do you have a prescription, Professor Murawski? I haven't read your book all the way to the end. I don't know if toward the end you're going to say we need to go back to a Cold War model or not.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, that we can't go home again. That's why a lot of the book is history.
Yeah.
For example, one reason, very simple reason we can't go home again, is that the Pentagon itself is much more privatized than it used to be 30 years ago. In other words, the Pentagon encourages privatization of research now. So there's no sense in which if we just handed it back to the military science managers, you know, they would offset or undo many of these trends that I've identified. It wouldn't happen that way. Mm.
Let's get another call in. Russ is calling from Revere. Hi, Russ.
I was calling because I think that my biggest concern about the privatization of science is the fact that the private sector has a very specific agenda, which is to make money. And so that one agenda skews the type of research that's going on. You end up having multiple different antidepressants, which essentially do the same thing. But because of the money-making potential, that's what ends up getting the research funding. And you see less funding for things like antibiotics, which end up having a tremendous amount of antibiotic resistance and don't end up being very, very good money-makers. So these kind of things, I think, do end up showing a trend as to where the science ends up going, and you don't have science for science, just you know, science research for the purpose of discovery and actual moving science forward.
Got it, Russ. Thanks so much. Philip Murawski, does Russ have it right? I mean, is that one of the concerns that...
I didn't mention this. This is yet another concern that I have about the biotech sector. Hmm. I mean, you're right. There's a lot of building and a lot of activity around Kendall Square. But take a look at the aggregate number of new molecular entities reported by the FDA. So you don't have to believe me. You have to look at the FDA. The FDA says the truly new treatments, new therapies in drugs have been falling for more than 15 years. So here we've had this huge influx of money that your other speaker told you about, and yet we're getting back less in the way of truly new drugs. And why is that? Part of the reason has to do with the privatization. That what happens is that when you get a new molecule, a me-too drug, a drug that does something very similar to what an existing drug does, is as valuable as a truly new therapy. And so what are you going to go for? You know, we already understand that part of the world that we're researching. So what you get is this incredible wave of me-too drugs instead. That's one very good example of how privatization alters the content of the science being done.
Well, the book is Science Mart, Privatizing American Science. The author is Philip Murawski. He's a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. Philip Murawski, thank you so much for talking to us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
We also heard from Vineet Nijhawan. He's the managing director of the Office of Technology Development at Boston University. And Mr. Nijhawan, thank you so much for joining us today as well. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks as well to our callers. Listeners, the conversation continues at radioboston.org. Up next, we meet some greenhorns, educated young people taking up farming in the name of sustainability. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.